Scott Woods here from rockcritics.com. It's March 7th, 2010, talking once again to Mr. Bob Dobbs. How you doing, Bob?
Great. I'm looking forward to doing this Meltzer. I love reading Meltzer in this context and going through it, so I'm glad we're doing it.
Excellent. Well, this is episode 10, and it's actually Academy Awards night. And I know you didn't watch it, and I didn't watch much of it because we've been talking on the phone for a little while. But you were telling me what Hurt Locker won Best Picture, right?
Yeah. Is that a good movie? Have you seen it?
I've seen it. It's a good movie. It's an interesting movie, but I never really felt that engaged with it.
Okay.
It's okay. And I'm glad Avatar didn't win, but that sounds like such an obvious thing to say. It's easy to flag Avatar, but Avatar was a gorgeous looking movie in parts, but the story's ridiculous.
Yeah, no insights, just cliches. Working for the Antichrist, for the New World Order, kind of stuff.
Noble savage kind of shit.
Yeah, and you know, dumb beast empire. I mean, life's way more subtle and complex than that now. Especially when the Android meme is making us all feel in love with our computers and iPhones, you know, so it's a different level of seduction. The image of nature is not going to save us.
Okay, cool. Okay. I don't know what to say to that.
Okay, so let's see if Meltzer has something to say to it.
Okay, so we're flipping through Aesthetics of Rock, as we have been doing, and we're going to try and do this diligently over the next few episodes, hopefully. So I have given you a bunch of pages, and we're going to start at page 127. By the way, I'm pretty sure that in every edition of Aesthetics of Rock, the page count is exactly the same. I think they sort of organized the book in that way so that all the footnotes are on the same page and all that stuff. So 127, I initially sent you starting at 128 because that's where I found it really interesting, but you thought there might be some context missing. So let's look at 127. I find it a bit more than a mouthful, and it's, you know, there's a lot of references to Aristotle and stuff, and I'm pretty lost there. So do you want to read, maybe? Or?
Okay, so I haven't read it before, so let's see where it goes. The analysis which Aristotle uses in application to dramatic forms, which are sufficiently long enough for difficulty to arise, that means the analysis is long enough, right?
Yeah.
Contains a jargon which, once familiar, actually molds the experience of movement and change in viewing actual instances of tragedy. Now, I left out the middle part there just so we get the sense. Actually molds, in brackets, even too regularly, which might be judged negatively, so actually molds the experience of movement and change in viewing actual instances of tragedy. Okay, I'm not sure where he's getting at, so let's go to the next sentence. Quote, this is from Aristotle Poetics, these should each of them arise out of the structure of the plot itself, so as to be the consequence, necessary or probable, of the antecedents. There's a great difference between a thing happening propter hoc and post hoc. I don't know what propter hoc and post hoc means, but it looks like he's talking about linearity. You know, visual space is coming into the Greeks, and they're making a big deal out of a sequence, like a domino effect, right? That's what he's seeing. One thing changing and moving into the other, leading to tragedy. So let's continue to the next sentence. Such a systematic understanding of plot rigidifies audience anticipation. Okay, even though I don't know where the sentence goes, such a systematic understanding of plot rigidifies audience anticipation. He's objecting to the Gutenberg linear narrative effect. And he can do that because he lives in an instant gratification environment in the 60s, right? So let's see if that's where he's going. Such a systematic understanding of plot rigidifies audience anticipation and leads to such, perhaps destructive, alterations of the art object, as into one which transforms discovery into merely discovery of a new taxonomic opacity, that means density, or one whose interest is now the particularization of such taxonomic opacity. Robert Brumbaugh, in describing the University of Chicago project in the 1930s to apply an all-inclusive grid of analysis to art, specifically that of Aristotle's four causes, states, and that's very interesting, he brings in the four causes. McLuhan did a lot on that. Specifically that of Aristotle's four causes states, quote, one might, for example, concentrate on expression, the author as efficient cause, on style, the medium, the material cause, on idea, a platonic notion of truth or message as a disembodied formal cause, or on audience effect, a rhetorical reduction of the work of fine art to a remote final cause. Now, this is really interesting. Because
so are those four causes right out of Aristotle?
Like yes.
He's quoting this guy, but...
Yeah, the four causes, and I know a lot of the four causes from reading McLuhan in the 70s, because he emphasized it. And McLuhan...
The tetrad?
The tetrad parallels, but let's not get into that. There's just four. What McLuhan said was what is the four causes? The material, the final, formal, material, final, and what was the... See, you get it mixed up with the levels of exegesis, so I got to do this. Okay. The levels of exegesis are the literal level, then the symbolic level, and then the moral meaning, what was called the tropological level, and then the eschatological level, which is grasping for straws in mystical uncertainty. Those are the four levels, and they kind of, McLuhan paralleled the four causes. So you got the literal level, the symbolic level, the moral level, and the ultimate mysterious level. That's the four levels of traditional analysis of the Bible, you know, in medieval times.
Okay.
The four causes are formal cause, material cause, efficient cause, final. Okay, I got them. Formal cause, material cause, efficient cause, and final cause. Okay. Efficient cause is how the thing is done. Like if you want to hammer a nail in, you grab a hammer, and the hammer nails the nail. That's efficient cause. The material cause is you got a metal nail and a metal hammer, right?
Okay.
And a piece of wood. The materials of the event, what makes the event happen, nailing the nail in, and what's the final result, which is the cause you're leading towards, or the final result, the nail has been hammered in and the joints are holding, something like that, right?
Okay.
The formal cause is the bugaboo. McLuhan claimed that once we got into the Gutenberg galaxy, we lost a proper understanding of formal cause. And McLuhan said formal cause was looking at the effect on the users or the effect on the audience. The audience is the formal cause. What are we doing this for? For somebody, for the audience. We're creating something, we're expressing something for somebody. That's the audience. So the formal cause is who you're doing it for. How do you get it done? Well, you do something efficiently with certain materials, and you go towards a end point. Okay? So that's what I learned from McLuhan, is that the formal cause, that the audience was the reason for the effect, for the art object or the invention, that got lost with the Gutenberg press because it made everybody go hyper-efficient cause, or what we call progress. Let's just keep making more stuff, get real efficient, get everybody here in the factory and produce stuff that will help everybody, having forgotten, well, what would be the effect of this product on the community? What is the media effects? You know what I mean? So formal cause got lost over the last 300 years, and then it came back in beginning in the 60s with the idea of ecology. What is this doing to the earth? And people did a lot about, well, technology was ruining people, ruining nature. But advertising was secretly using formal cause all along in the 20th century because they always studied the effect of the ad on people, using Nielsen ratings and all kinds of focus groups. So McLuhan's point was that formal cause came back in unannounced by academia, came in unannounced in use by advertising. So he said that Eliot Pound and Joyce and Lewis started to see the retrieval of formal cause in this sense, the effect on the audience. And McLuhan picked up on that and ran with it. Whereas most people, they say, let's invent something, let's bring in cold fusion and see what happens. The Western dynamic is, let's just get this done. Let's make this new thing. We don't care what effect it has. So, that's my framework for looking at the four causes. So McLuhan, his revolution, academically, was we forgot about the proper use and understanding of formal cause in the Western industrial phase, and now we're flooded with audiences demanding their the effects on them to be acknowledged. So formal cause came sneaking back in.
But we didn't know
that's what the four causes were until McLuhan explained how the formal was lost and then got retrieved. So with that in mind, and I read other guys' interpretations of formal cause, and it was kind of idiosyncratic. Nobody could agree on what the four causes were saying. But McLuhan wasn't necessarily into the definition. He was talking about how one was lost and how it was retrieved. Okay, and probably maybe people wouldn't even agree that formal cause was the audience. So, with all that in mind, let's look at what Brumbaugh in the 30s says the four causes are, okay? Because that seems to be what Meltzer is using. And you know that the McLuhan level I've just explained, Meltzer wouldn't know about and didn't get. So that's what I'm going to look for. What is the effect of that based on his understanding of causes? So he says, one might, for example, concentrate on expression, the author as efficient cause. Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, how's the work get done? By the author. But McLuhan said the artist or the author was really interested in the effect of his work on the audience, and therefore was really focusing on formal cause. So right there, it's debatable. But accepting the practical thing that the author is creating the work, so he is the efficient cause, and he's expressing. He's creating, manifesting something. On style, the medium, the material cause. Okay, now that's looking at the record player, the medium as the material cause, not including the idea of medium, as McLuhan defined it, as the effects on previous environments. So McLuhan is taking the word medium and bringing in a formal cause element on it. And this is not being done here. It's interesting. Style would be the content of a product, not the record player, you would think. But anyway,
style would be the what, sorry?
The kind of music it was on the record player.
Right, yeah.
And the medium, as McLuhan meant it, would be the record player and all the other media before there was record players.
Right.
Definitely this is way different from McLuhan. Style, the medium, the material cause.
Yeah.
Now, an idea, a Platonic notion of truth or message as a disembodied formal cause. That's not bad if you think the message has something to do with the recipients of the work. Then you're getting sort of in the idea that the formal cause is who's receiving the message, right? But to call it an idea is really an abstract, visually biased version of what formal cause is affecting. So anyways, it's really awkward what's happening here. An idea, a Platonic notion of truth or message as a disembodied, abstract visual space, whereas McLuhan said formal cause is the material audience that's being affected and all the media that the audience already was using before the new medium came in, or the new art object, okay? And then he says, or on audience effect, which we know McLuhan means formal cause, a rhetorical reduction of the work of fine art to remote final cause. So you see, this is really mixed up from McLuhan's point of view, right?
Okay.
But you can see, in a normal, literate, logical sense, well, what's the final cause? Well, the results on the audience.
Right, yeah.
It kind of makes sense. I think
follows in that way, yeah.
Yeah, what?
It does seem to follow a from beginning to end sort of path.
Yeah, if you're not concerned about the effects of what you're making, you just want to create something efficiently and have an effect on the audience, then this is an industrial interpretation of the four causes. The author makes something, he uses material, that's the material cause. He has some kind of larger idea, which is a disembodied formal cause. That's highly suspect. And then the effect is the final cause. So McLuhan says, I'd have to remember, if the final cause in McLuhan's sense is the fact that it arrived, the fact that it got done is, I think, McLuhan's final cause, but that is not looking at the effects on the audience. That's the formal. So you see, I'm bringing a total different way of looking at the four causes. I can understand why a literate person would see the four causes this way. So that's Okay, so that's why, first of all, you have to know this stuff to understand what the hell Meltzer's getting at, right? So now you know what he's talking about. I mean, you know what he's wrestling with, Aristotle's four causes, and they're important. Because Aristotle was the first to break down, to bring out the levels of analysis of a phenomenon. It was the first literary detached thing that the phonetic alphabet McLuhan felt caused. The Aristotle's breaking down the logos. For Homer's period and before, a more acoustic society, not involved with the phonetic alphabet, they did not break up the resonant logos, they danced it. Or they had incredible memories and got involved in the Homer poet singing this poem for hours. You know what I mean?
Right, right, okay.
They weren't trying to figure out who was being affected. They almost didn't have a sense of individual persons being affected because it was a group mind. Now with the phonetic alphabet and the Greek idea, emphasis on the individual, and the new idea of democracy, individuals equal before the law, even though it was class limited, but anyways, in general, the notion was we got a bunch of individuals and they have equal say in the matter. You're breaking up the effect of the logos and you get to people like Plato and Aristotle starting to divide up the dynamics from an I-based, EYE-based situation. Okay, so all that, here is Meltzer bringing in visual space book learning into a post-book environment. And that's where a lot of Meltzer's confusion is. He's trying to apply his philosophical training in university to something that is not literary. And we will see he knows that.
Right, right.
But he puts on the philosophical legacy, the visual space, because people back then read books like that and needed to know that and needed to fit it in. So the thing is how much is Meltzer aware of the put-on he's doing?
Right. Well, it's a microscope that he can use or something.
He needs to bug the professor.
To use something to get, you know, to get into the analysis of the stuff, and that's not the convenient thing, but it's the available thing, I guess. I mean, he can't just by him going out dancing or something, he's not going to get across the aesthetics of rock.
Right. And he thinks he has to relate it to philosophy, and that's the appeal of the book, because many people, especially over the last, you know, back then in the 70s, 80s, had a bit of philosophical training, comes with literacy and their college education, and so they liked how he wrestled with concepts.
Right, yep.
But he certainly is not trying to be the literate person to nail it down into a concept, because he knows that's useless. But he's in between. He's in the tactile interval. So let's go on to see where this paragraph goes.
Yep.
But what becomes of the work... now he's bringing in a question, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But what becomes of the work of art when it is grasped for its style, medium, material cause, or audience effect, taken as rhetorical reduction of fine art to remote final cause? Now, I have to read that again, but he's beginning to realize that the traditional literate four causes don't work.
Right, and he's got that whole sentence italicized.
Yeah,
which kind of gives it a like almost a let's get real here kind of quality to it or something.
Well, it's the crux of the matter for him.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's amazing, of course you wouldn't know what the hell this paragraph means if you didn't have any philosophic training knowing about the four causes. You'd say, what the hell is he going on about, right?
Exactly, yeah.
you would think, oh, there's a cause and effect. What is these different kinds of causes? But what's interesting, the industrial era brings in a reduced level of a simple version of cause and effect, which medicine has become. And yet, here's Aristotle. It's still an acoustic culture. You know, he's bringing in the new technology, the new computer, and it's new and unwieldy for people because they can't even think visually like Aristotle. But you see, he's aware of the multi-leveled situation, which is natural in an acoustic sensibility, preliterate society, so he's kind of come up with four levels, four causes.
Right, right.
And even that's like medieval dancing on the head of a pin kind of complexity for the average mind in the middle of the 20th century. You're practical in the 20th century. You're coming on desperation. There's a cause and there's an effect. What are they? What do you mean the medium, the audience, and the final? That's nonsense. That's medieval complexity, right? But you, when you understand that we were coming back into complexity because we were going into acoustic, audio, tactile space, and the simple visual mapping wasn't working anymore, and Meltzer knows that in terms of dealing with art and culture and fine art.
Right.
So he's actually retrieving the Aristotelian complexity. He doesn't know how McLuhan's pushed it even further, but it's useful for him to bring in these four levels. But of course, the average person reading the book wouldn't know what he's talking about. But he took this stuff in college, you know. He's got this training, and it's really like the genetic aspect of a media effect of literacy. It's almost like a genetic thing in American culture, in the Western culture, where we have to filter it through our literate background. It's just that he is putting in the academic literate complexity. I mean, he's saying stuff that you, a literate person, can't even understand why he's saying it. But it has a context. So he's saying, but what becomes of the work of art when it is grasped for its style, medium, material cause, or audience effect, that's all the four, taken as rhetorical reduction of fine art to remote final cause? He's actually raising the question that McLuhan had. If the remote final cause is the audience, which McLuhan wouldn't agree, but that's the tradition here, the audience effect, what becomes of the work of art if you don't reduce it to fine art? He says, if you take it as rhetorical reduction of fine art to a remote final cause, that is not enough. He's almost saying you do have to bring in the other three causes.
Right, so let's see
if that's what he gets to in the next line.
Okay.
Its aesthetic opacity is now a philosophical opacity, or density, or a mixed aesthetic-philosophical opacity. This is trivially true for the object of any philosophical analysis. But in the field of temporal art experienced in time, an Oedipus Rex upon which can be superimposed a convenient grid of analysis such as Aristotle's, becomes Oedipus Rex tragedy or Oedipus Pex Rex tragedy, each part of which can be taxonomically labeled promptly. Okay. So you can see that he might have been in a philosophical seminar at university where you get all this jargon in your head and it flows off you easily when you've been talking it with fellow students and your professor for 3 hours, right?
Right, yeah.
So it's like he's walking home thinking all this, you know, ivory tower stuff, and then he comes home and turns on the radio and Like Rolling Stones on, and he just gets all excited, and he's trying to relate the concepts he's imbibed for 3 hours to the immediate experience of art coming through immediately, right?
Right, yeah.
So you're actually having here, it's unfair for the audience readers because they're not involved in the three-hour seminar with all these concepts, and they're certainly not thinking it as they listen to Dylan.
Right.
There's jargon here, and we can go into the jargon because let's go back to the top. Now that we've worked our way through the paragraph, it's leading. I'm not sure what the last bit is, but in the field of temporal art, experience in time, that means pop art. You're experiencing in time, I think. And Oedipus Rex, upon which can be superimposed a convenient grid of analysis such as Aristotle's, becomes Oedipus Rex tragedy, or Oedipus Rex tragedy, each part of which can be taxonomically labeled promptly. Ah, okay, so because you're taking more information immediately with a Dylan song, you got many categories that'll pop up because it's faster, it's more involving, and that's what he's getting at here. Each part of which can be taxonomically labeled promptly. There's a sense of immediacy there, which is different when you're reading a book and have time to, you know, deliberate over the concepts that you're dealing with. He's trying to apply these labels retrospectively to the experience of the pop song he's engaging.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say he's trying to figure out how to take the literate jargon and fit it to the experience, knowing that there's no comparison. It's not useful, but he wants to try and make it useful. So we go back to the beginning. The analysis which Aristotle used in the application to dramatic form. So you have theater, tragedy, comedy, but the dramatic form for the 1960s person is the incredible great music coming in dramatically at you. The Beatles just released Sgt. Pepper's. Oh, wow, what a great album. You know, it's dramatic. It's not a theater dramatic. It's not a theater. You're not going to the theater. You're not going to, you're not reading something. It's immediate, and it fits with the idea we're in a global multimedia theater. So we are in a global theater in the 60s, And you can bring in traditional theatrical genres, tragedy and comedy, that's sort of half relevant because you're having a dramatic experience in the present.
Right.
You're listening to 2 hours of music with all kinds of stuff going on. Okay, so the analysis which Aristotle uses in application to dramatic forms, okay, can this be applied to the modern dramatic pop culture, which are sufficiently long enough for difficulty to arise? That means the dramatic forms, the theater, the two-hour play, long enough to have all kinds of thinkings and questionings and thoughts about what's unfolding in front of you, right?
Yeah.
So he's actually talking about the span of time. Literature is slower, time to work conceptual conundrums about it, as opposed to the instant world that he's writing about, right? So they don't have any time. They happen immediately. So that I think
right.
I'm getting what he's saying. He's saying the old theatrical forms took a while, and that analysis which Aristotle used it dealing with them contains a jargon which, once familiar, and it is familiar if you go to school and have seminars on it, contains a jargon which, once familiar, actually molds the experience of movement and change in viewing actual instances of tragedy. Now, that's odd, even too regularly, which might be judged negatively. So what is the actual instance of tragedy? He's talking about old theater? Contains a jargon which actually molds... Okay, I think he's saying the jargon is appropriate to old theater events. Contains a jargon which, once familiar, actually molds the experience of movement and change in viewing actual instances of tragedy. Okay, so you're watching a play, right?
Right.
And the categories, the four causes, fit the experience because it's long enough. See,
when he's saying viewing actual instances of tragedy,
that means
talking
either...
About real life, is he talking about, like, real-life situations?
He could be. He could be, yeah. So let's say that's what he's doing, because what's an actual instance of tragedy in the 60s is Vietnam.
Right, right.
And so there's lots of music about that and bouncing off that, so maybe he means his media diet. See, this is where he's not being precise enough and creating needless difficulties. He should have said, what is an actual instance of tragedy? Is it an actual play you went to see, or... But let's say he means actual life, because he's saying the word actual, right?
Right, and the word tragedy does come up in his book a lot, so that's why I thought he was just talking about a tragic situation or something.
Okay, so what is the tragedy he's referring to throughout the book?
Yeah. I don't know. I know that word comes up quite frequently, and he uses it a fair bit in relation... He relates it to pop songs as relating... As communicating a sense of tragedy.
Okay, so some of the
that's
songs...
That's the way he most often uses it.
Oh, okay, yeah. Many songs are about sad experiences of the singer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so let's assume that's what he's referring to and not make it too complex. So he's saying Aristotle's analysis to old theater contains a jargon which, once you handle it, could apply it to pop culture. The experience of movement and change and viewing actual instances of tragedy. So I think maybe saying, I think we can use Aristotle's categories here to the phenomenon of rock. So let's assume that's what he's saying. Because he says actual modes, and then he says even too regularly, which might be judged negatively. In other words, it molds you so much, it's so useful, it actually could be too much of a habit, is almost what he's saying. And then it becomes
negative. Right.
So then, what is a tragedy? I guess it's a story unfolding. So he quotes Aristotle on... movement, a plot. These should each of them arise, so let's assume he means the aspects of the four causes. Each of them arise out of the structure of the plot itself, so as to be the consequence, necessary or probable, of the antecedents. In other words, the result of the previous causes. So it is implying something causes, material cause leads to a final cause, right? These should each of them arise, the four causes, out of the structure of the plot, because it takes time to unfold, so as to be the consequence, necessary or probable, that means you might see it coming, of the antecedents. Okay, so he's talking about the domino effect here. Something causes that leads to this. So it goes from material cause to final cause. A message to the audience is how that definition. There is a great difference between the thing happening propter hoc and post hoc. In other words, it would help for us to know what those two Latin phrases mean, but taking a guess, great difference between a thing happening now and later. Okay, I'm not sure where. Can you look that up?
I'm going to look them up. Yeah, I mean it would make sense. Okay, post hoc ergo propter hoc, Latin for after this. So that's post hoc.
And propter hoc would be before.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
There's a great difference between a thing happening before and after. Hmm. Maybe check propter hoc. Does that mean before?
Checking it. It's weird. In Wikipedia, they're both tied into one definition. So let me see if I can find it somewhere else.
So it's either happening as you witness it or happening in a story about something that you after. It might be just a level of detachment. You're involved or you're...
I think propter hoc, there's a Wikipedia page, correlation does not imply causation. Is a phrase used in science and statistics to emphasize that correlation between two variables does not automatically imply that one causes the other.
Okay, so there's...
This is also known as cum hoc ergo propter hoc.
Right, so post hoc is the opposite of that. You do know something follows from something, right?
Right.
That would make sense. There's a great difference between a thing happening coincidentally and effect from a cause. Yeah, okay, so I can see that there. So Aristotle said, see, here's Aristotle, he's not rigid. He can see both. He can see simultaneity as opposed to linearity. But that's the genius of the Greeks. They're just beginning to get in visual space, so they have a good, healthy inclusion of acoustic simultaneous sensibility. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Okay, so there's a great difference between a thing happening simultaneous and linearly. Okay, let's just leave that. Such a systematic understanding of plot rigidifies audience participation. So he's saying, didn't he just say that the jargon was useful? It's useful, but then now that he's no longer literate, because literate people, you know, in the Gutenberg phase, they loved laying out causes. It was a novelty. They had the ability to do it. They were conditioned. They didn't have overwhelming radio canceling out their desires and everything. But Melzer's talking in the Electric Age. And he can see the rigidification caused by the linear breaking down of the plot.
Right, right.
So such a systematic understanding, systematic, and definitely, in other words, you detach and you apply the formula everywhere. Take that professor, put him in a dance hall or just a modern rock concert, he ain't going to be able to apply his formula that easily. He's going to be distracted by all the noise and you drinking of alcohol and pot and stone and people vomiting and people dancing. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Bakunin used to say, you can't teach somebody the alphabet if they're in the middle of the Amazon River fighting off crocodiles or alligators.
Right.
Okay, such a systematic understanding of plot rigidifies audience anticipation. Yeah, I agree. And leads to such alterations of the art object. In other words, they don't see what's happening because they are projecting a formula that they're used to onto the unfolding of events.
Right, right.
Okay. At least it says perhaps destructive, not necessarily, destructive alterations of the art object, as into one which transforms discovery into merely discovery of a new taxonomic capacity. In other words, what's interesting is literacy made reality opaque. It made it thick. It's like Ion says, the veil was created. This emphasis on the eye and getting in the rabbit hole of visual space made matter opaque. And then science had to unravel it. Whereas pre-literate people, everything was alive and resonant, and they could see through it. There was a transparency because they weren't locked into the eye. So let's say that maybe taxonomic opacity, taxonomy is looking at something after it's dead, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's dead, and then you do taxonomy on it. You find out the forensic process, looking at the causes.
Or whatever, yeah.
Right. So he's implying that post hoc is looking at something after, and then you're pretty good at doing that, so you have a systematic application of the taxonomic opacity. It's almost taxonomic disservice because you think things are hard to figure out. So I think that's what he's saying. So he's again talking about the literacy effect. It's probably not too useful when you're dealing with the immediate now of cultural arts in the global theater. So So, such a systematic understanding of plot rigidifies audience anticipation and leads to such alterations of the art object as into one... So the alteration is, transforms discovery into merely discovery of a cause of a new taxonomic capacity, or one whose interest is now the particularization of such taxonomic capacity. So, in other words, you over-intellectualize what's going on. But that's a cultural grievance. Ever since there were books, people didn't like bookworms because they were too intellectual and they missed the spontaneity of acoustic environments.
Right.
And so he's saying, you've got these causes. They are probably useful only for a short time because there's a lot more going on in the pop culture environment that if you use the literate formula, you're just going to be looking at a corpse and missing the livingness of it.
Right, right.
Okay, so that gets us some... It makes... You can follow... I mean, you probably had no clue what he was getting at, but now you get a clue, right?
Yeah. No, it's starting to follow it.
Yeah.
And then when we get to the next paragraph, and not to jump ahead, I think it definitely helps fill that out. So,
yeah.
Keep
so
going.
So he's saying, hey, there's a new medium here, and maybe the four causes cannot be applied as they're
not
traditionally
adequate.
Defined, right?
Yeah, it's not adequate.
Yeah, and so here's again, if he had known McLuhan, he would have found out McLuhan would have explained to him the formal cause. Yes, the formal cause has shifted. It's no longer the Platonic idea, an abstraction or visual space. It is something right now with audience mechanics and Nielsen ratings and what's popular. Now, what's interesting, the formal cause, an idea, a Platonic notion of truth or message, disembodied, that is actually the definition of visual space and its effect on people. It made people think the abstract semantic meaninglessness of the phonetic alphabet was this archetypal space. Remember I was telling you how St. Augustine concretized this, you know, 700 years later into a self, this abstract third thing? And that's what... And so what's amazing, literacy created this effect of the idea, and it's the idea, the content, that they call formal cause, but actually McLuhan would say the formal cause was the literate effect. So it's actually, they're calling the effect the cause, whereas the cause was the environment of literacy. For me,
okay.
That's very interesting how it's they're looking at it upside down. The formal cause is the effect of literacy on the audience, and the effect is to create the notions of the Platonic archetypes and abstract ideas, which only can come out of the phonetic alphabet, and they're mistaking the effect for the cause and misusing the real meaning of formal cause.
Right, okay.
Formal cause is the effect of the alphabet. They describe the effect, an idea, a Platonic notion, as formal cause. Actually, that's the efficient cause, almost. Or the final cause. The final cause would be the effect on you. But it's caused by an environment, which is a formal cause. Okay, enough of that. But I'm glimpsing at what, for me, is a bit of irony in here, right?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so then he goes back to the simple point, hey, these four things may not work. But what becomes of the work of art when it is grasped for its style, medium, material cause, or audience effects taken as rhetorical reduction finite to a remote final cause? I think he's complaining there. If you take it as remote final cause, you've got a problem. Isn't that what this question means? He's not advocating it to be rhetorically reduced, right?
Yeah, no, I don't think so, yeah.
Yeah, but what becomes of the work of art when it's taken as rhetorical reduction of fine art to remote final cause? Okay, so I'm assuming he means by that the final, like I just said, the final cause is the idea, the Platonic idea. It's not formal cause, it's final cause. The idea is a reductionist notion of archetype. So he's actually beginning to see the final cause should be what McLuhan means by formal cause. You know what I mean?
That makes sense
to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's aesthetic opacity. In other words, this confusion is now a philosophical opacity. Yeah, it's an aesthetic opacity because aesthetic is looking at the sensory dynamics. The fact you're abstracting visual space is missing the acoustic dimensions. And then that becomes a mental activity called philosophy, which is book people thinking about what the books have done, and they miss the effect of the book on changing the dynamics.
Okay.
It's aesthetic. If you say aesthetic opacity, Aesthetic is kind of looking at the formal effects.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but it's opaque because you're not noticing, you're putting the formal cause in the wrong place. Therefore, that'll cause aesthetic confusion. Is now a philosophical opacity or confusion, or a mixed aesthetic-philosophical opacity. Again, this is exactly the issue that McLuhan was addressing.
Okay.
And Meltzer is noticing he's on the right path here. He's noticing there's a problem here, and he doesn't know that McLuhan has, quote, solved it. That's what's interesting. He is noticing the problem, that we've got different causes here going on in different sensory modalities, and that's going to lead to aesthetic confusion right off the bat in terms of what you experience, and then in the book world, it's philosophical confusion. That's what opacity means. You're not seeing through to something. Or a mixed aesthetic-philosophical opacity. The mixed thing would be figure ground in McLuhan terms. The philosophical effect, the conceptual confusion, is the figure, and it's the effect of the medium, which in Meltzer terms is the aesthetic effect.
Okay.
Aesthetic being the sensory layout. But it becomes a concept whether it's beautiful or not. But anyways.
Right.
And then he says, this problem, this is trivially true for the object of any philosophical analysis. Now that's an interesting statement, because if you don't know what the effect is of the phonetic alphabet and the book on your philosophical concepts, that is noteworthy, but it is not noteworthy. It's trivial because in the Gutenberg era, everybody loved figuring out concepts because that was the effect, the drug of print.
Right. Okay.
So he's almost saying this is trivially true, this confusion, for the object of any philosophical analysis. It is true for anything that a literate philosopher will bring to the object. He brings his visual bias. But what's interesting, he says, it's almost like it ain't trivial. It's very important. See, he's saying, hey, this confusion caused by the philosophical analysis applies to everything. But to Meltzer, that's too general. It misses the particularity we want to get here. And he doesn't know that that's what McLuhan came up with. The medium is the message, to many people, is a trivial insight. But when you realize how important it is, once you understand it, it's not trivial, it's the bottom issue. But Meltzer doesn't get that, so he just thinks it's trivial when you notice that, oh, this happens in all philosophical analysis.
So what causes that disconnect?
Let me just say immediately. The phonetic alphabet, remember, is A, B, C, D, E are letters that are semantically meaningless. When you learn things through speech or ideograms, the teacher would say tree, and the sign for it would look like the tree. But if I say tree and show you the letter, the letters T-R-E-E, they don't look at all like a tree.
Right.
It's a level of abstraction and confusion that's brought in. This is the main insight that McLuhan's saying, that Havelock and Innes started to pursue too, especially Havelock. The abstraction caused by semantically meaningless letters with acoustically meaningless sounds, abacadu is the way McLuhan used to say the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, abacadu.
Right.
But there's no onomatopoeia going on. And you know, in tribal acoustic societies, things would be named because the sounds of them would resonate with the names they came up with.
What do you mean they would evoke them?
Yeah, like the word babbling. They'd say the rook, they'd listen to the river, the water babbling, and they'd imitate it. Babble, babble, babble.
Right.
The word
okay,
babble.
Yeah.
But onomatopoeia. That would be in their particular language, not the word babble. But they would mime the sensory, full sensory impact of the phenomenon they were trying to name. The name would have the elements of the thing named.
Okay.
So that leads to a right hemisphere, more intuitive environment, which is what we're having. You know, rock criticism is trying to articulate onomatopoeic effects. This is an interesting point I'm just discovering. You listen to a song, And then you try to mime what it means. You can't use any literary category, so you dance it out.
Yeah.
And you actually are primitive, trying to find the term or the paragraph or the meaning onomatopoeically.
Right.
Like, you know, you go to, what did rap sound like, people? What did rap sound like when Public Enemy showed up and Mike Dyer went to this concert in 1989, he told me about it, I think it was in Montreal, you know, the guy who did Radiohead. He went and saw Public Enemy. It was a whole new phenomenon. He came back kind of puzzled, but liking it, but I didn't know what it was. I don't think I knew what Public Enemy was right then. I might have known a month later. But he was trying to describe it, and he couldn't come up with words. You know what I mean?
Right.
So he was trying to express a complex environmental effect, and the words he would come up have to resonate with the experience. It's not a cat. You can't come up. Well, it's a category. It's Addison's disease. It was Addison's disease. No, it wasn't. You know what I mean? Look at that. It's the beginning of his book. Him trying to explain the bird is a word, right?
Yeah. Okay.
If you think I'm saying onomatopoeia means that the word sounds like the phenomenon that it's naming,
right?
Okay. So you go to rock multimedia experience at a concert. There's so much going on. What would you say, what word would resonate with the experience? Usually it's wow, or it sucked.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You reduce the amount of words you're going to use to describe the multi-leveled experience because there's so many more media than just words in a rock concert.
Right.
Or a hip-hop experience. Probably a few fucking fights broke out, or somebody vomited. I mean, how do you limit that to words? See, that's why speech and reading got sort of lowered, because people could just put their headphones on and fly away.
but why is? I mean, on the one hand, I get what you mean, but when you say like you're limiting it by trying to just use words to describe.
Yeah, I'm saying look at that's why rock criticism came up. That's why Meltzer and these guys started writing. They were trying to wordize the experience, and at least Meltzer recognized the difficulty of it.
Right.
And that's good. But it's even more absurd. He's recognizing the difficulties of critical activity that he's learning at university, and how inadequate it is to trying to sort of write something about what's happening.
Yeah.
In the rock world, this is what he's always doing.
No, that's true. Yeah,
he's making the mistake of bringing literate concepts into this situation.
Well, although would you describe it as a mistake? Isn't he the fact that he's grappling with that itself? I mean, he's
yeah, his grappling. Well, this is where McLuhan says ignorance creates wealth. He's coming in with not the McLuhan equipment, which probably would have led to no book. Okay, so people.
That's a contradiction, because McLuhan created books, obviously.
You call those books?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Actually. I've often thought of that, like, some people used to tell me, oh, they can't read McLuhan because it's just, you know.
It's the same sentence every page.
It's bad prose. And
yeah, it's repeating. He's saying the same sentence.
Yeah, I mean, is it also right to sort of say that his books aren't, they're basically, even his books that are, you know, are not obvious collages like The Medium and The Massage and War. They're all kind of collages in a way to me.
Yeah, that was his mosaic method. He describes that when he lays it out in Gutenberg Galaxy. I'm not saying it's not literature. It is using
that's
the
not
book.
Literature, yeah.
Yeah, it's using the book and the retrieving the eye to look with a visual bias at what's going on, which is exactly what Meltzer's doing. McLuhan would say Meltzer is wrestling with a lot of concepts, literate concepts in dealing with it. Whereas McLuhan didn't use too many concepts.
Said percepts, right?
Yeah. He would just say, well, this is a great rock concert, but there's a guy over there mowing the lawn. Acoustic machine, you know? He would juxtapose events around him in the community, not concepts that come out of a book.
Okay.
The limited concepts of book, which he's calling philosophical activity, they're not limited, but it's like Meltzer hears this global theater, sees it, and then jumps inside a book and runs around inside the concepts of the book to try to map it onto the post-book reality that's happening. McLuhan doesn't find concepts. He says Barth did that, took the phenomenology of the present and related to historical philosophical concepts. A lot of the Pomos do that, Derrida. McLuhan didn't take book concepts. He just said, you got this rock concert, simultaneous acoustic experience. That's similar to what people experience when they're driving down the highway in their car. It's similar to what happened in medieval periods. He starts juxtaposing chunks of scenarios. You know what I mean?
Right. So is to use concepts to sort of look at an object and try and make sense of it, whereas using a perceptual framework is more just an all-inclusive, or not all-inclusive, but like a more expansive, comprehensive view of things. Is that?
If you think it's valuable. Many people didn't think McLuhan's approach was valuable. They rather wrestle with the concepts. That's why they like Derrida and Barth.
Okay, but I'm just asking the question in terms, like, is that a proper way to frame it in some way? I'm trying to get at the difference between, because I've always been a little confused by that in McLuhan when he said, I don't use concepts, I use percepts.
Right.
That's what I'm just trying to get at that. And I'm seeing it as concept is almost, it is literary. It's looking at something and
writing it down.
Writing it down, whereas percepts is using all of your senses and no time and space kind of thing.
Well, not so dramatic. That's true, but just percepts is McLuhan goes on the local radio show and explains the twist.
Right.
He doesn't do a scientific study, lab results, and then publish in a peer-reviewed journal the effects of television on 7 people. You know what I mean? He goes on Robert Fulford and he says, this twist is like Cape Canaveral. It's like the beginning of the space program. He's juxtaposing whole environments, putting them together, and you can do it with speech a lot faster than with writing it all out. Joyce tried to write it all out, and he made an incomprehensible splash on each page of a whole bunch of factors.
Yeah.
Okay, so the... But university, built on the book, the postmodernist theorists were acceptable in the 70s and 80s to deal with this new post-book world because they had nothing but concepts and kept it within the book parameters. McLuhan was what they call a poet manqué, a bad critic, a critic manqué,
right.
M-A-N-Q-U-E, with a acute on it. French word for a rebel, an outsider, an outlaw. Outlaw critic because he went out of the book rules of analyzing things by writing books by just getting on there and creating other media, engaging other media through speech. So that's percepts, not working with concepts, which are a product of literacy. You don't have concepts in pre-literate societies, and you don't have concepts today in people's actual experience.
Yeah, okay.
You do have people go to school, take a degree, a useless PhD or something, and engage in the book stuff, memorize the concepts, and write a stupid thing, and then get a piece of paper, and then go out, and there's no job for you.
Right.
So we're quadrophenic. We can engage literate, we can engage concepts, but our actual society is molded by a perceptual quantum fluctuation where you never saw what you were looking at because you never heard what you heard. Remember that quote from Kroger?
Right, right. Yeah.
That's the way we live today. It's okay, so you could say that Meltzer is naively, futilely trying to make something out of his conceptual education at Yale and apply it to what he's really involved in.
Right.
And
right.
It's a hopeless cause, but for those that like concepts, have that training and know it, it's a great run. It's very entertaining to read his wrestling, and it's conceptually complex, and literate people, sophisticated literate people, like complex conceptual thinking, and that's what we got here. So
yeah.
It's a great book as a book, but he's actually trying to point to stuff going on outside the book.
Yeah. He is aware of that, I think.
Right? Yeah, he is aware of that. And he probably even could have said a few McLuhan stuff. He probably knew a little bit of McLuhan, but you have to have in-depth understanding of McLuhan. But on surface level, he probably knew that he was going to do McLuhan and do it better. because he probably thought McLuhan was just some stodgy old literate Catholic professor up there in Toronto. He wasn't dealing with the Fillmore East and all that.
Well, it's and he points a few times in the book, I think, or maybe elsewhere in his writing, to other people who obviously were probably influenced by McLuhan. So he probably got a lot of it secondhand. Like he actually seems to cite Warhol quite a bit. But the stuff he sort of cites by Warhol, I think it's like the more kind of McLuhan-esque stuff out of Warhol.
Right, right. Okay, I've just looked at the next paragraph. Look, the whole...
Yeah, and that's exactly... This next paragraph...
It explains what we're saying.
This is the crux of almost everything.
Okay, very good. So, just to jump in, the whole analysis of music bit, which is, you know, he's trying to do, sort of calls for the use of a pack of words to tack onto a pack of sounds juxtaposed with another pack of words. This is exactly what I'm trying to say, right?
It's a perfect sentence, yeah.
Okay, so we know it's leading to that, so let's go back to the complex stuff in the previous paragraph and clean it up. So he's noticing that the final cause does not seem to work here. Its received definition, he notices, is not working, right?
Yeah.
Its aesthetic opacity, meaning the final cause aesthetic opacity is now a philosophical opacity. We did that, or a mixed aesthetic philosophical opacity. This is trivially true for the object of any philosophical analysis. But in the field of temporal art, experienced in time, I think that means pop culture, you're experiencing it now, right?
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
In a quick 3-minute thing, not a long drawn out theater piece.
Yeah, yeah.
And Oedipus Rex. So it could be that it's a tragic song, you know, one of those, what is it, those girls?
Like a Shangri-La.
Yeah, a Shangri-La song, a tragedy in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's a quick, instant Oedipus Rex. And Oedipus Rex, upon which can be superimposed a convenient grid of analysis such as Aristotle's, becomes, okay, but in the field of temporal experience and time, so then he's saying, we're going to use Aristotle, right? Such as Aristotle becomes Oedipus Rex, tragedy, or Oedipus Rex tragedy, each part of which can be taxed on the label promptly. I'm not sure about that last bit. He's saying there's two kinds of Oedipus Rex here.
Yeah, Oedipus Rex or...
Oh, okay, Oedipus Rex tragedy, that's the literary 3-hour or 2-hour play that leads to a tragedy, tragic end. Or Oedipus Rex pop culture, tragedy, each part of which can be taxonomically labeled promptly. He means instantly. You're thinking it as it's happening in the 3 minutes.
Okay.
That's what he's saying. In other words, you use the dead analysis of Aristotle taxonomically, but you do it promptly, quickly.
While it's going on, while it's happening.
While it's happening. And that's how he writes this book.
That's how he writes. That's definitely how he writes. He's listening to songs, and he's getting that down on the page.
Right. So it's like needlessly complex and ridiculous, but but it's a fucking, it's a PhD. He's writing this originally for his Yale class, right?
Right,
So he's saying, you damn guys, you make me write this crap, and it's so irrelevant to what's going on. Let's drop these categories, but no, I got to use these categories or I won't.
Yeah.
And then the funny thing, he does this, and then he gets fired anyways.
Yeah.
He gets kicked out. And then he carries on, and he writes a book with the same game. I'm going to put on, you know, for the Fluxus, something else press, you know, this New York sophisticated art aesthetes. They'll want a lot of philosophy and Nietzsche or whatever in there, so I'll provide it for them. Because I did it back at Yale.
Yeah.
But he updates it. But what's really great is that he's miming the problem of writing the book, which is what Phoenix Wake is. It's a book about the impossibility of doing a book to deal with the radio movie and coming TV environments. You know what I mean? He's doing so. This is a tradition. This is hyper sophisticated, you could say, postmodern criticism. Because postmodern guys dealt with this later, and you know, and McLuhan and Meltzer are being postmodern right when the professors are just beginning to work out a stupid system for it.
Well, that's funny that you say that too, because I think Greil Marcus in his introduction says this book it predates deconstructionism or whatever. He says it's deconstructionism before deconstruction. I don't know if he says it
correctly. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Like that, but it's deconstruction before deconstruction became the thing.
That's a preface written in the 80s?
Yeah, in around 86.
Yeah, he couldn't have done that in 70 or 72 because
it was to the reprint, a forward to the reprint.
So he agrees with me. Now, what's interesting, McLuhan takes it a meta level. McLuhan explains why deconstructionism shows up. Meltzer doesn't go that far. Or if he does, it's probably limited, and that's why he gave up, because he didn't use the bigger tools that McLuhan offered. Because, you know, Meltzer's probably even... He probably says, okay, this is deconstructionist, but who gives a damn about deconstructionism? But for you guys who think it is, I did it back then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, this is good. Let's go into the next paragraph and probably clinches this. How far is this? Okay, it's just another...
Yeah, and I say let's get through this paragraph, and we may have to call it an episode.
So he made this complex paragraph, and then he's sort of saying, well, you don't realize how ridiculous it is that I did that, but it's appropriate... Because the whole analysis of music bit sort of calls for the use of a pack of words to tack onto a pack of sounds juxtaposed with another pack of words. Yeah, pop songs are sounds and words.
Yeah.
And he has to reduce it to a pack of words in the book format.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's saying it's bigger than words, the rock experience. There's sounds. Every creep who's ever bothered with that has to groove on how silly... Holy shit, I'm psychic. He's saying what
he
said.
He sounded like
And I haven't read this before. Every creep who has ever bothered with that has to groove on how silly, in the good sense, the whole operation has to be. Now, it's a good sense in the sense that, hey, we're literate. We're writers. We like to write. We're going to write about it even though it's futile, because writing's fun, and there are a lot of people who like to read books, so that's my market. That's my formal cause. That's my audience.
Yeah.
It's not a final cause. It's a formal cause. Then he goes... How do you talk about music anyway, particularly when? Now, it's interesting. Ben Watson, he says he likes to talk. The more important thing about a music experience is to talk after it. You know what I mean?
Right.
I should send this point and make that point to Ben, because Ben thinks you can talk about music, and that's the best part. Ben being a logocentric, literate, talking, visual person, right?
Right.
How do you talk about music anyway, particularly when... ... Now, okay, what's he going to... Why does he fade out when? It's also a matter of temporality and analysis, that scene. Okay, good. It's more than talk.
Yeah.
Aristotle, the original pumper... What's a pumper?
Yeah, I don't know. That's odd.
It's sort of like the original idiot. The original jerk, creep, who tried to talk about something that couldn't be talked about.
Yeah.
But luckily pulled it off, because talking and writing was new then, and it was the new iPhone. Everybody loved it.
Huh.
It was good for the next 1,500 years. Aristotle, the original pumper, he pumped up the categories, gives you a hunk of quasi-decent, explicit categories that make it so that you alter the way you see drama forever. See, when literacy came in, it altered the way the Homeric poems and culture was seen. It changed people. So he's saying, he's describing the media effect. He gives you a hunk of quasi-decent, explicit categories. So he recognizes the four causes, which are a little more more comprehensive than this linear cause and effect. So he's retrieving the oral literate density, complexity of the Greek culture. Aristotle, the original pumper, gives you a hunk of quasi-decent, explicit categories that make it so that you alter the way you see drama forever, right? Like you see it as Aristotelian sculpture drama, right? Sculpture was an important art form in Aristotle's system, which is a groove, but it drags too. Okay, it's a groove. You can bring it back, retrieve the complexity of the four levels, early literacy, bring it into rock criticism, but it's only still literacy, and he knows it doesn't even make it. It doesn't include enough. Which McLuhan did include enough, you see? I'm just putting a little promo in there for McLuhan.
Yeah.
Which is a groove, but it drags too. So you take the concept of the rock track. It's short. It's not a long, tedious, grinding thing in front of you that you not only have to pay attention to keep up with, but where labels sort of imprison your whole temporal thing, that means the enjoyment of a song, with the expectation, bummer, because they're so easy to stick on legitimately. He's talking about what a drag it is to watch a two-hour play.
Right.
But look at the sensory pleasure of watching a play. When you don't have electronic music, nothing much is happening, but you're probably involved in milking the cow and all that agricultural stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Before industry, in the modern era.
Yeah.
A three-hour play is great. It's exciting.
Yeah, Yeah.
And so he's here is Meltzer making the obvious point that, hey, there's new arts going on here, but you literate people think high art in the book world is the only art. You're missing all this great experience out here.
Yeah.
And I'm not even going to bother making categories for it, because they can't keep up with a post-literate experience.
Yeah, okay.
So you say, hey, there's great pleasure happening here. Okay, but you can urinate on Sophocles anyway, the doors do. So let's go back. So you take the concept of the rock track. Okay, an instant thing happening. Now, it was pop track in 1965 when he first was writing. Now you have albums take over in the late 60s, so it's a 15-minute song, right? So it's a rock. But that 50 minutes is very short compared to a two-hour play.
Well, and he footnotes it, so read the footnote maybe, because he says, so you take the concept of the rock track.
Oh, okay.
It's short, and then he has the footnote about it's short.
Okay, part of the original basic rock move is the short track. It's easier to take a short track and pack it pumice full with goodies than a long one. And then the long one takes on too much of the temporal ordeal drama aura. But some rock guys, notably Doors and The Who, have been able to carry the move into that. Okay, it's right at that point about how long should we listen to our... How much is concept albums coming in, and he's ambiguous about that.
Yeah, it starts...
He's almost like a junkie.
Color TV, basically.
What?
Color TV and everything.
Yeah, he's basically a junkie. He wants his hit right now, and I can get it. I can get it on the radio. I like pop music. I'm not fuddy-duddy about whether it's high art or not. I like the Shangri-Las. I like thinking about it as it happens.
Yeah.
That would be taxonomically labeling promptly in different conceptual parts of what goes on in a three-minute Shangri-La song. So you take the concept of the rock track. It's short. It's not a long, tedious, grinding thing in front of you. This is a good description of theater. A long, tedious, grinding thing in front of you, visually, that you not only have to pay attention to keep up with, but where labels sort of imprison your whole temporal thing with the expectation bummer because they're so easy to stick on legitimately.
Right.
So he's actually saying the labels you come up with as you think about it get in the way of the direct appreciation of the drama.
Right.
But you can urinate on Sophocles anyway, the Doors do. In other words, I think he's saying there, hey, it's a post-literate world, we don't give a fuck, we don't need plays. We got music. I'm not going to the theater. I don't care about Joseph Papp and his public theater. I can just turn on my TV or stereo and have fun.
Yeah.
Is that what he means? You can urinate on Sophocles. You now can urinate. You couldn't during pre-electric era. It's sacred stuff.
Do you get that?
Sophocles was an important experience. You had nothing else going on. To have a three-hour play was a great way to escape. And you wouldn't urinate. That's a valuable experience. But when you got movies and all this other stuff in the 20th century, who cares about some old puny play? It's puny.
Okay. And what's the thing about Sophocles? Do you know, like
Sophocles was a great author of tragedies in Greek time.
Okay.
He's a great tragedian.
Right. Okay.
But you can urinate in Sophocles. He's actually saying, hey, you're free from the literary environment. You're in a multimedia environment, and he knows, hey, you can do all kinds of things now that people couldn't do back then when they really needed a tragic play to watch every now and then. And then he says, the Doors do.
Yeah,
the Doors. The Doors put on, you know, the end. They put on, probably gets into this, they imply classic pretensions. You know, Jim Morrison being a poet, a great poet. And yet they can't stay stuck on that track or motive. Because there's too much else going on. You're having a great concert. You got all these groupies, and why write anything down? And you get drugs. I mean, the Doors, they better say that they didn't mean it, anything serious. And then they can say, we don't have to be serious in literate terms. We're just giving you a great experience.
Yeah.
We're giving you a great percept. Forget the concepts that Jim is a great poet. That's back in the literate phase, which doesn't apply to the 60s.
Right, okay.
So then look at we won't go too much into the next thing, but just look, once we get it, it's very interesting what he says. He goes, superimposition of explanatory labor. See, he's like McLuhan, repeating the same dilemma every page.
Yeah.
Here's a bunch of concepts, and the first half of the page, second half, isn't that ridiculous? It ain't dealing with what we're talking about, or what I'm trying to say I enjoy.
Yeah.
Or that. So the superimposition of explanatory labels is, however, spiritually acceptable in rock. Isn't that what I was just saying? About Morrison being a great poet?
Yeah.
Yeah, just as is the heroine.
Isn't that in a lot of ways what the book is really about? Melcher's book? Is that, like, that the book itself, I mean, I think you've said this, that his book itself is inadequate to the situation he's trying to describe.
Yeah, and he's putting down everybody else who think they're being literate phenomena and not recognizing the very environment they're in.
Right.
And they should, yeah, so he probably says this in the next line. We're starting to get synchronistic here. I think a thought, and then I see he says it. Just as is the hair length and color of a rock performer grasped in conjunction with his musical. Okay, this is important. The superimposition of explanatory labels is, however, spiritually acceptable in rock. Just as is the hair length and other aspects, not spiritual, of a rock performer, spiritual in the literate sense, of a rock performer grasped in conjunction with his musical performance. Yeah, there's more than music going on.
Yeah.
His hair length and color of the rock performer is just as important as...
Yeah.
Okay, the superimposition of explanatory labels is, however, spiritually acceptable in rock, just as is the non-spiritual activities. But over time, as McLuhan predicted, he said rock becomes the new shamanism. The hair length and color did become the spiritual aspects of a perceptual experience of music.
So what do you mean by that?
The style of the person determined his success or not. You know, glam rock, punk rock, what they wore, the hair length. Look at these punks. They got short, no hair. That was spiritually significant.
Right. Okay.
They were making fun of the long hair,
yeah.
Baby boomers.
Yeah.
So actually it does become spiritually, and I guess, is that what he's trying to say here? The superimposition of explanatory labels is, however, spiritually acceptable rock. It is acceptable in the boomer phase of the 60s when there's still literate people around. And they want to know what the conceptual reference of is, whether this is art or not. You know what I mean? This rock. 10 years later, it's not important. Just as is the hair length and color of a rock performer grasped in conjunction with his music performance. Okay, he's sort of saying people are schizoid. They want to have literate spiritual categories going on, but they also know that the hair length is important too.
Yeah, yeah.
It has been suggested that no work on aesthetics, beginning with the Poetics, Aristotle, has ever done justice to the total work of art, including those elements which are not artistic. That's exactly what Don Thiel writes about in his great criticism. So, I think my phone's starting to blink, and it's getting late for you, but...
No, this is a good session.
Yeah, I think if we remember, we won't do this for another 2 weeks, probably. If we can only remember what we just learned, and we'll see, it's going to happen on every page. But I enjoy going through all the concepts.
Yeah.
Because I'm a literate person.
We'll pick up. So you describe yourself as a literate person. I'm surprised.
No, yeah. I mean, you are...
That's not all you are, though.
Here's the point McLuhan made. If a kid never went to school but grew up in the suburbs or any industrial place in the 20th century and never learned to read, they'd still be literate because the industrial linear structure you live in, caused by literacy and developed as an environment, is the left hemisphere effect. You walk down a street with a suburban street with straight lines. The environment is linear in a book. That's an important insight to get McLuhan. And I end my show with that.
Okay, good.
That you can be literate even though you can't read. Like blacks, here's a great point. American blacks in the 60s, 70s were literate people. That's why the African blacks who did not grow up in literate industrial straight line streets could not relate to the American blacks and thought it was ridiculous. The American blacks were trying to say they were African.
Okay.
That's a very important point there. Too bad it's 20 years out of date, it's about issues that aren't even important anymore, but it's what, if McLuhan had been given a forum, he could have explained to everybody. Back in the 70s, who knows what would have happened.
Yeah. Okay, let's end on that note.
Okay, great.
Back in 2 weeks, Bob.
Okay, thanks a lot, Scott. A lot of fun.
Take care. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.